You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Ah, kumbawa, everyone.
Evan.
Kumbaya, what was that?
Kumbaya.
Kumbaya, no. Kumbawa. Japanese for good evening.
Good evening.
Lots of SGU listeners in Japan. We know a few.
So apparently Rebecca has some kind of phlegm situation going on.
I didn't know she was Flemish.
We're trying to decide if she has the flu, whooping cough, or strep throat.
Well, get this, guys. So Rebecca emails us and says that she's not feeling well, that she woke up like really late today, and she's been basically zonked all day. And at the same time, we have a little whooping cough scare going on over here with the newborn. This is what happened. My sister-in-law came to visit from Denver, and in the Midwest, you know that the whooping cough incidences are higher and everything. And I just, didn't really think much of it other than everyone in the family got the Tdap vaccination, which is the whooping cough.
Did she and her family get the Tdap?
Yeah, they did.
Okay.
But what I found out today was that, like many of the vaccines that we get, they're guessing at which strain is going to be the one that's going to hit that year. And
hang on, Jay. What you're describing is relevant for the flu. With the whooping cough, it's not that there's like a different strain hitting every year. It's just that the Tdap covers only a very narrow number of strains, and the virus is mutating. It's just new strains are developing. But it's not like it's a seasonal strain like the flu. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, I didn't mean to confuse that. Like, I know exactly what you said, that there is a newer version of it that just wasn't covered by that particular vaccination that we got.
Yeah.
So her sister left on Monday morning. She called us up today. We're recording on Wednesday. And she said, guys, I had a bad cold on my way home, and now it's turning into something that is very, what I would consider to be whooping cough-like.
Yeesh.
So we called up our doctor. I have a 3.5 week old in the house now, right? So, very dialed into this. We called the doctor up immediately, like, what's up? Like, what do we do? What happens? And pertussis is a bacteria. It's not a virus. So they have an antibiotic for
antibiotic.
It.
Antibiotic. Yep.
So what do you call it, Steve? Erythromycin?
Erythromycin,
yeah. So
it's common.
That's the one that they use for it. And, it's the mega dose, like two pills the first day. And then you take, like, this mega dose thing for 4 days. Of course, the baby's taking like the liquid form and everything, but I'm sitting there tonight with my wife and we're giving the baby like his first medication, and it's freaking whooping cough medication. Like, I wanted to strangle people. Thank you, everybody, for not,
anyone who has never gotten your kid vaccinated for whooping cough.
Yeah. Something that
way to blow the herd immunity. Way to go.
Get rid of it. Did you guys see the infographic of the CDC puts out information every year, and somebody made an infographic of the incidence of morbidity before and after the vaccination for a particular disease came and went, right?
Yeah.
And, right out of the gate, like things like smallpox and stuff, I don't remember the exact numbers, but like we have certain diseases where there was like 500,000 people dying a year down to zero after the vaccination. And there's like in this infographic, I think there was more than a dozen of them. It was incredible. Like, you see the numbers, how dramatically different they are. I mean, right there, that's 100% proof. They work, and yet people are walking around out there today, and they don't care. That information is meaningless to them. How? Why?
Well, what is the worst-case scenario with pertussis? I mean, how bad could it get?
It can kill you, Bob. It can kill a
death.
Baby.
That's bad.
Yeah, there was that famous case in Australia where a baby caught Dana McCaffrey, caught whooping cough. In a community that had very low vaccination rates because of the Australian, anti-vaccination network preaching against vaccines. And the baby caught it from unvaccinated people and died because the child was too young to be vaccinated. Right? It's one of the populations that need to be protected by herd immunity. Evan, so you're filling in for Rebecca this week for This Day in Skepticism.
I had said good evening in Japanese to start the show, and I did so because, the compact disc. You guys remember what compact discs are? CDs?
They're still
optical discs.
They're still technology that's used today.
They are. Their first, most common usage was, of course, for music storage, right? playing playing music. You could put 80 minutes of uncompressed audio on one of those things. That's 737 megabytes of data. What do you think of that? So in Japan, you know, is where the CDs were first widely became available in October of 82. However, on March 2nd of 1983, compact discs and their players were released for the first time in the United States and other markets around the world, whereas they had only been available in Japan before. But finally, they came to the United States, and I remember this vividly. It was a big effing deal for me and my, you know, 13-year-old friends and stuff who were all, in our own opinions, very big into music. And it was a rush to see who would get the first CD, who would be able to afford the first CD player. It was kind of, you know, it was bragging rights in a sense. Do you guys remember that
Oh, yeah.
Time?
Yeah, instantly replaced tapes, records. 8-tracks had already died a death by then.
Thank goodness.
But, yeah, and the think about it, guys. It's 30 years. And they're still a perfectly acceptable technology. I still buy CDs for music.
Really?
Sure.
Oh, man, I just download it all.
Yeah, the thing about it, your CD, you could then rip it into any quality MP3 you want, which you own without any DRM, and you have the CD for a backup, and it's still cost-effective. It's not like you're saving money by downloading. So it's still a perfectly viable technology. It really has had a lot of longevity.
It's all right, I guess. I hear a song that I like, oh boy, that sounds really good, and I buy it. Within literally 4 minutes, I have it on my iPhone and I'm listening to it. That's awesome.
I do that too, but if there's an album coming out and I know I want the whole album, I'll get it on a CD.
Something to remember, guys, is that when you purchase a CD, you're purchasing something physical that you actually own. And when you're purchasing a license to get a music or something you download through iTunes or something, there's debates right now going on in the courts as to, well, how much ownership do you actually have over that thing? In other words, can you put it into your estate and leave it to your heirs? And they are fighting that. The record industry or the industries, you know, don't want those rights to be transferred on to descendants. But with a CD, you're guaranteed. That is yours. It's physical. You can do whatever the heck you want with it. So you got to keep that in mind also in the debate about, you know, what medium, what format you're going to use for your music.
Oh, that's messed up.
All right. Well, Bob, talk about looking for life around dying stars.
If you insist.
I do.
So, guys,
like Mickey Rooney, are we talking? What are we talking here? Dying stars.
Oh, boy. Guys, when you think of an extraterrestrial planet, especially one that supports life, I mean, what do you think of? You got this planet orbiting a parent star that's kind of like our sun, right? Maybe it's a little bit bigger than our sun. Maybe it's a little bit smaller. And of course, if that's the case, the habitable zone around the star changes because of how big and bright the star is.
Bob, I think a Tatooine with two suns.
Yeah.
Nice orchestral music playing.
Or
in the
Rigel 7 with a big, you know, planet in the distance with rings around it.
Yeah, but still, it's like it's a real star. It's like a star that is
not a
fusing
star.
Right. It's fusing hydrogen into helium. No, but it's not a dead star, and that's the point here. There's a new theoretical study that finds that the most likely place possibly to find life on another planet may be around a dead star. More specifically, of course, a white dwarf. I'm not talking about like a neutron star or black hole. But not only that, they think they might be able to actually find one of these planets in the next 10 years, which seems like a pretty bold prediction.
But Bob, isn't a white dwarf after the star went through its initial sort of expansion then came back in on itself, wouldn't it have kind of destroyed things?
And that's the huge problem. It's the first thing I thought. Well, how can that be? You know, a white dwarf is a dead star. It's a corpse. You know, of a sun-like star, at the end of its, you know, in its old age, it swells into a red giant and it totally crisps any of the planets that were nearby. But before it expels a lot of its mass, making the beautifully misnomered planetary nebula. So what's left is this collapsed core. It's about as big as the Earth, but it's got the mass. It could have a mass of more than the sun, 1.4 solar masses, I think. Is the Chandrasekhar limit for that? So that's a lot of mass in a really tiny place. So clearly, it's unbelievably dense, right? If you had a ton of white dwarf matter, if you could do that, you could fit it into a matchbox. I mean, it's super, super tiny. You could thank the electron degeneracy pressure for that. But there's no nuclear reactions going on to produce energy. But because it's relatively small, it can radiate its remaining heat for literally billions of years. So clearly then, this thing could have this its own little Goldilocks zone to support life, even though it's really not even a star anymore. And it's not creating energy, but it's just radiating away the energy that's contained in it and for many, many, many eons. So then the next question then, Evan, which ties into what your comment was, how does a planet get there? Because the red giant's going to wipe out anything that's nearby, probably anything that's in the Goldilocks zone. So there's actually two ways that could happen. One might predict a planet can migrate in from the outskirts of the solar system. We've seen that with hot Jupiters, Jupiter-sized planets that have orbits closer than Mercury. You know, how the hell did they get there? Well, they could actually migrate in through the solar system. But there's another way. A planet can also form from the leftover dust and gas. And that of course would be a second generation world, which I think is pretty cool. Now, of course, though, this planet would have to get pretty damn close since the heat source is so small and dim compared to regular living stars.
Bob, do we know that either of those things can actually happen around a white dwarf, though?
The thing here, though, with this theoretical study, Steve, is that they've ran these really sophisticated simulations, and they've pretty much shown in the simulation everything that I'm talking about. That this can happen. They're incredibly confident that it could happen. They can think of no reason why it wouldn't happen. Now, it's not like every white dwarf is going to have one of these. They're saying that among the 500 closest white dwarfs to the sun, they might find one or two that have planetary bodies in orbit around it that could support life. So, you know, one or two in 500 isn't great odds, but I mean, there's lots of stars and we can look at a lot of different things. So the interesting thing is, as you could imagine, these planets would have to be very close to the white dwarf in order to get enough heat to have liquid water and life evolve. So that turns out to be only about a million miles away, which is what? 1/93.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, our orbit's 93 million miles. So it's way, way, way close to it. And, its year, of course, would only be about 10 hours long, which is an amazingly fast orbit. So that would,
that's a party every 10 hours.
I calculated Rebecca would be over 30,000 years old if she lived on that planet. So, all right. So we've got this dead star that could conceivably keep a nearby planet warm enough for life. So we got that. We've got a couple different ways for a planet to arrive or form nearby. So then the next interesting question is, well, how do we detect this thing? And if you regularly listen to this show, I think you probably know the transit method, right? A planet mm-hmm. moves between us and their star. The light output dips. And bam, you've detected a planet. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's essentially the idea. Now, in this scenario, it's actually even better. Now, think of this system, though. You've got a planet real close to a white dwarf, and the white dwarf is so tiny. I mean, they could be comparable in size. So that when this planet eclipses the white dwarf, you're going to have a huge dip in the light output. It would be an obvious signal. It would just, like, leap out and say, whoa. Mm-hmm. This starlight almost completely disappeared.
But so the plane of that system would have to be perfectly aligned with
yes,
with us.
it would have to be. But even if it wasn't, you could still occlude half the star or 33%, and that still would be really, really good. That's not even the best part. The real icing on the cake for this is that the white dwarf emits so much less light, it becomes much easier to determine the composition of the atmosphere of the planet in orbit around it. And it turns out that after the simulation I was talking about, they showed that after just a few hours of observation, instead of something like hundreds of hours, we would know that the planet has perhaps water vapor or maybe oxygen in it. And oxygen, would be gargantuan news. That would be huge. Yeah. Because on Earth, anyway, oxygen is created by life. You take away life from the planet Earth and it would slowly diminish. The oxygen would just disappear. It would dissolve into the oceans. It would oxidize the surface. And if we found a sizable amount of oxygen on a planet, I think it'd be pretty solid indication that there's probably some kind of life on the planet producing that oxygen. And if not, then maybe it's some kind of alien machine that's creating it. And it wouldn't matter because in that case, we would find life anyway. So either way, it's a win-win.
So now we just got to look for them.
Yeah, and the James Webb, the James Webb is a big thing. That once that guy comes online, that telescope comes online, I think geez, I'm not sure when, within a few years or so.
They plan on a 2018 launch date.
That is going to have what it needs to really survey these white dwarfs and find these planets and maybe find a planet that most likely has life on it. And how huge would that be? Talk about the science story of the millennia, let alone the year.
Yeah, we'll probably cover that when it happens.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Evan, I read that geologists claim they have found a lost, sunken continent.
You read correctly, Steve. And courtesy of the BBC, their headline reads, "Fragments of Ancient Continent Buried Under the Indian Ocean."
Hmm.
So, what do you think? Is this it? They finally found Atlantis? Is the evidence incontrovertible?
It's in the Indian Ocean, so it wouldn't be Atlantis. It would be Indiana.
Yeah, I suppose that would be more
accurate. Indianas.
And if only
Indianas.
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 I like it.
There are a few outlets out there, not exactly of BBC quality, with their own headlines, including "Fragments of Ancient Continent Atlantis Found," and Atlantis is all in caps with a exclamation point, and the word "found" is as well. And another one that says, "Is this the real Atlantis?"
Nobody knows.
So, you know, geez, that was not predictable at all, that some people would be jumping all over the Atlantis part of the story, but it has nothing to do with Atlantis whatsoever.
Zip. Zero, nada.
Nada. Nope. This article focuses on the study published in the journal Nature Geoscience. And like you said, Steve, the researchers have found evidence for the landmass. It would have existed up to about 85 million years ago. Can I give you a quick little story to set this all up? So a long time ago in a galaxy called the Milky Way, almost a billion years ago, and that was before, you know, iTunes and compact discs and vaccinations, on the Earth there existed a supercontinent. A supercontinent is one very large continent, while at the same time there are no other significant sized landmasses anywhere on the Earth. There have been many, many supercontinents that have existed on the Earth over the history of the Earth.
Oh,
just a few. Well, about a dozen or so that they have listed online. But the supercontinent from this particular era was called Rodinia. You guys may remember learning, I remember learning in grade school about the supercontinent called Pangaea, right?
The most recent one, yeah.
But
and Gondwana Land is the
one,
other
right?
one.
That one, Gondwana Land.
Was that Guana Land? Was that made of bat poop, the whole island?
Yeah.
Pangaea, about 300 million years ago. No, Rodinia was well before that, about 750, maybe 800 million years ago. So we're talking a long time ago. As far as this particular new landmass that was discovered goes, picture in your mind a world map, okay? And look in your mind on the map for the country India, okay? And then to the south, the island nation of Madagascar, all right? Well, these areas were once connected. They're part of Rodinia, and they were smashed up right next to each other. And researchers have believe they found evidence of a sliver of a continent known as, well, they call it a microcontinent, that was once tucked between these two masses. And but not only have they found the evidence, they're already calling it something. They're calling it Mauritia, named after the tiny island of Mauritius, which is the place where they actually discovered the evidence. So what kind of evidence did they find? Well, they collected samples from a volcanic eruption that took place, estimated 9 million years ago. And within the samples of those sands and grains that they took in were mixed in some much older minerals. They uncovered zircons. Now, zircons are known in geological circles for being found on the continental shelf, and they are very, very old. These particular zircons that they found are estimated to be at least 600 million years old, and I read some estimates in some places that they could be almost 2 billion years old. The nearest known outcrop of continental crust that could have produced these zircons is on, well, Madagascar. But, you know, it's still very far away. And it's unlikely. They're trying to come up with scenarios by which how could these zircons have gotten there by other means. They think that this is evidence for a landmass that actually, you know, believes a microcontinent that exists out there below the Indian Ocean. And they're going to be doing more studying about it. They're hoping to do more research and being a more detailed mapping of the floor of the Indian Ocean and continue this research and try to find the sunken continent.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I read the paper itself, and I mean, I think what they demonstrated is pretty solid, but the notion that the source of these grains of sand that they examined is this sunken microcontinent that existed between India and Madagascar. That's really just a hypothesis at this point. It's not like they've found the continent or they've proven that it exists. It just would be one possible explanation for why this ancient zircon would be where it is. It sounds plausible. Sounds like a reasonable story, but again, I think just a hypothesis.
What in this context, you always hear them saying, you know, lost or sunken continent. What the hell does sunken mean in this context?
Below the water.
Well, yeah, but is it? But
it's you're right, Bob. It's a misnomer.
What's the mechanism? I mean, is it just erosion, like the islands near Hawaii that have been eroded into the sea after they moved off of the volcanic hotspot? I mean. Or did some cataclysm happen that actually made it, that shifted the crust and made it sink that because of that? I mean,
I think it's more to do with when a land mass breaks apart into two land masses, the piece in, you know, there may be some of it in between the two pieces that breaks apart and sinks under the ocean. You know, that's essentially what they're saying. Because just the way the crust broke apart, one interesting thing about the whole supercontinents, et cetera, is that, you know, we're still not really sure why continents even exist.
Why?
You know?
What do you mean?
How they,
why,
how they,
we don't know why they're there?
Essentially what happens with plate tectonics is you have the oceans are constantly turning over like a conveyor belt. So no part of the ocean is any older than a couple hundred million years. Parts of the ocean diving down below a continental plate and you have rifts in the middle where new ocean floor is emerging,
floor
and sort of
spreading.
Yes, yeah, so you have this spreading zone and then the subducting zone. But the continents are always floating on top of these oceanic plates. But how did that happen in the first place? Once it established itself to be that way, then you could see how it's self-perpetuating. But we're not really sure how that happened to begin with, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's cool.
The other thing that's interesting, the result of that is that continents are ancient. That's why stuff that's ancient has to be continental, right? Because anything from the ocean can only be a couple hundred million years old. If something's billion years old, it had to come from a continent because only continents are that old.
Yes, yeah. right. And that's why
which
the
is kind of nice
because
if the continents were also, you know, occasionally diving underneath other plates and recycling, there wouldn't be fossils, you know?
Yeah. We'd lose a lot of information.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on. I'm going to talk about electronic tattoos. What
the hell's that about?
Yeah.
It has something to do with Fantasy Islander.
Oh!
Here's the headline. You guys tell me what you think about this. Temporary tattoos could make electronic telepathy possible.
Telepathy. Would have been a great science
electronic. I know. If somebody didn't send this to me, I would have used it as science fiction item. Evan, you sent me several things I was going to use as a science or fiction. But anyway.
Oh, I undermined you totally.
This would have been, I would have had Bob going. It's like, now you're talking about telepathy? No telepathy. So what the technology is they're essentially flexible electronics that you can apply to skin. And because they're flexible, you know, you could move around, they could bend. They're very thin. And they can serve a few functions. One primary function would be that they would essentially be an electrode. You know, no big deal. So we could pick up electrical signals from the skin. So for example, if placed on the scalp, they could detect brain waves. But because this is like an electronic circuit, it's not just a dumb electrode. It's an actual circuit. You can build other functionality into it, including a transmitter. To transmit signals to, say, a device. So these could be used as very small, thin, flexible monitors. And so the technology seems very practical, very useful. I'm sure that this kind of thing is going to find a lot of applications. What I found amusing, maybe irritating, was the reporting of these devices. In terms of like what the possible applications would be. Because these are electrodes, you know, that could read electrical signals from the brain. They started speculating wildly about the most advanced applications of the brain-machine interface. Now, we've chatted about this too, but I mean, that's something that would be, you know, far enough in the future that we cannot say how long it's going to be, that we cannot extrapolate. The brain-machine interfaces we have now are actually very good at, and getting better at, reading movements. So because we can map out the motor strip, you know, the motor cortex, and, you know, you could put a lot of electrodes along the motor cortex, and then people can learn how to use a robotic arm, for example, just by thinking about what they want it to do, because it's interpreting the signals in their motor cortex. So that's about where the technology is now. But telepathy would require being able to read somebody's thoughts. And there, the limiting factor isn't the electrodes. You know, it's not the signal.
It's a brain and a skull.
It's interpreting. Well, even if you had brain surface electrodes that were in incredibly high fidelity reading the EEG, you know, the electrical signals from the brain, we still wouldn't know how to translate it into
how do you turn thought?
You know what I mean?
Into a digital signal. Like, what's the interpretation? And everybody's would be different. That's the real problem.
Well, you'd have to calibrate, you know, and partly the machine would have to calibrate to you, but also the user could learn how to use it, you know. But this will not allow for telepathy. That's the bottom line. This doesn't really get us any closer to telepathy.
But the headline, look at the headline.
In fact, the researchers admitted that brain surface electrodes would work better than these. These skin surface electrodes are probably never going to have the fidelity, the discrimination, you know, to be able to read thoughts.
Yeah, it just makes more sense that they, you know, let's say they surgically implant something that is the analog to digital interface for the brain, then it transmits it to another device and let all the computer power happen somewhere else. It doesn't have to happen on the surface of your skin.
Yeah, well, that's what this would do too. I mean, this would like just sort of read signals, transmit it to your smartphone, and then you could, you know, communicate through your smartphone or operate your smartphone with thoughts alone.
Like if I were to think, dial my home number, it would activate my phone to do something like that.
We're not at that point yet with this, you know. But this could be useful for like paraplegic people who want to control a computer screen or control a robotic device. Because these are very thin and small, you could probably have a lot of them. But still, it's the signal. The signal's not as clear as the brain surface, as you know, invasive electrodes. So it remains to be seen how much utility these would have. But because these are, the advance here is that the electrodes are integrated with other elements, such as transmitters, and that they're thin and flexible. You know, so you could put a lot of them on the scalp. You don't have to wear this big, massive cap or something that's very unwieldy. So it does expand the number of possible uses, but it doesn't get over the problem of reading the EEG from the scalp, and therefore telepathy is not one of the applications of this technology, in my opinion. However, having said that, they did bring up the notion of sub-vocalizations. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yeah, yeah, no, that's cool stuff.
I don't think we've talked about it on the show, but we, off the show, have talked about it.
Yeah, so when you are saying words inside your own mind, you tend to move your face, tongue, and throat muscles in the way that you would if you were speaking them, just much more subtly. And there's actually been some research. I looked. It's not a lot. Not a lot, but there is some published research looking at detecting with skin surface electrodes the muscle movements in the throat and the face, and interpreting these sub-vocalizations. I'm reading some conflicting things, though. You know, some reviews say that being able to go from detecting these sub-vocalizations to actual words has been elusive. But other studies claim that they've been able to distinguish a number of different words from the EMG signals. But it's possible from a limited set of words, you know, that they could say that they can then know which one of those words that the person was thinking. So that's actually though. So, I mean, I think
it's interesting.
Yeah, that is plausible, and that may just be a matter of incremental progress. And these electrodes, so these tattoos might apply to that technology, right? So if you're using this as a way of detecting sub-vocalizations and the detection and analysis algorithm gets sophisticated enough, And, you know, the user may be able to learn how to do that. Cause you can, you know, I was doing this before the show. I was just thinking to myself and paying attention to what I was doing. And then also like try to maximize my movement, my sub-vocalization movements. You know what I mean? Like you can deliberately accentuate them.
Can you shut them off entirely if you think about it? I mean, or is it just this so subtle that you really don't have that level of control over it?
Well, in researching this, I did find lots of websites and even some published studies looking at the question of suppressing sub-vocalizations in order to improve or increase your reading speed, because apparently the sub-vocalizations slow you down.
So to clarify, Steve, if words are going through my head, if I'm sitting here saying to myself, oh, I've got to get up early tomorrow morning or whatever it is, I am having some type of muscular reaction in my throat every time.
Only if you're reading.
No, even if you're just thinking words.
Even if you're just thinking
words. You're saying
words
in your head, you are sub-vocalizing those words. Yes.
Right. Okay.
But the question is just can we detect and interpret those muscle movements with enough precision and discrimination that we could translate that into the words that are in your head that you're thinking. And this could give you a fake telepathy, like a pseudo telepathy. It's not really telepathy because it's through actual muscle movements, but that could still be really powerful. It still could functionally be telepathy. It's really not telepathy. It's probably better termed silent communication.
Yeah. Imagine the military being able to communicate with each other without having to make any noise.
Yeah. Or spies. It's silent communication. You can imagine dictating in a crowded room without having to speak aloud. All right, Jay, let's move on. You're going to tell us about Google Glass.
Yeah, baby.
So, Steve, this is a real milestone. This is one of the pieces of technology that I've been waiting for a long time. This is the beginning of real augmented reality. To give you a quick definition of what augmented reality is, so imagine a car mechanic that's wearing a pair of sunglasses and a computer is projecting onto the inside of those sunglasses a schematic. So the car mechanic is looking at the car engine and the computer's projecting, say, the wiring system. So wherever he turns his head, it'll look like it's in 3D. So he could see, or he or she could see, things that aren't actually visible to the naked eye because the computer is laying that on top of reality. It's like another layer, or putting layers of information on top of reality. Or a surgeon performing open heart surgery would be able to see the heart in a 3D view, unobstructed by the rest of the tissue surrounding it or the rib cage or whatever. You know, having that vantage point gives people the opportunity to achieve things much faster, more precisely, and, you know, with much greater success overall. Now, I'm not saying that Google Glass is offering that to us right now, but what Google is offering is the very first step in true augmented reality. So let me give you a quick list of the features of what it is, and I'll describe to you. The actual component that you're wearing is, it's like taking a pair of sunglasses, removing the lenses, and then on one side, on one eye, they'll put a little module there that has a piece of glass that's hovering in front of one of your eyes. It'll project into your vision onto that piece of glass. So you're looking through that piece of glass with one of your eyes. It'll project a computer screen that looks like it's floating 3 or 4 feet in front of you. That doesn't have any borders or anything, of course. And there's simply information there. You know, there's text, there's, you know, however they're showing this information, it's going to be a varying degree of different things. And you're going to be talking to it. You're not going to be using a keyboard or a mouse or anything. That you're primarily going to be using vocalization to turn it on, to tell it what you need it to do. And some of the features that it's launching with are, it's going to be able to record video. What you see, it's going to record. It's going to take pictures. You're going to be able to start Google Plus Hangouts with people. You're going to be able to search. You're going to be able to also search photos, which is cool. You're going to be able to do translations. You're going to be able to get directions. You're going to be able to use the Google Now software, which is like iPhone's Siri software, where you can ask more complicated questions and actually tell it to do certain things, like, you know, take notes, you know, put something in my address book, in my calendar, whatever. You can send messages to people, and you can give flight details, or there'll be flight detail database attached, so you can call that up when you need it. You would start each command with OK Glass, as if you're talking to someone. OK Glass, I want you to start recording video right now. okay, Glass, stop recording video. The really cool thing about this, though, is you take it with you. It connects into your iPhone or to your Android operating system, and it is based off of the Android operating system. And you wear it, and you just put it on, and you forget that it's there, and it just becomes another interface for you. The big thing here is, guys, it truly is the beginning of the next way that we're going to be interacting and experiencing reality, and it's going to be augmented by computers in a way now that we've really never experienced it before. We're all going to be able to do things that we normally wouldn't be able to do, even simple things. Like, let's say you went to IKEA and you bought a bookshelf. Everybody knows that directions that come from, you know, companies like IKEA or whatever, some are better than others. But for the most part, having to construct something is a complete and total pain in the ass. This would be showing you what to do. It would be giving you visual cues using the actual things that you're looking at, like, you know, showing you what pieces connect to each other and where.
And that's the key, Jay. To me, that's the key. It's contextual information. It's not, you're not just surfing web pages. You are seeing overlays on reality, and it knows what you're looking at and gives you information based on your environment and what you're interacting with. And that's one of the reasons why this is going to be so powerful.
All right, Bob, but what would be the porn application?
Oh my God. Don't even go there.
Oh my God. Come on.
Bob's talking about what it will be like down the road, and I'm incredibly excited about that. Maybe, you know, a future use of this would be that you could tell Google Glass, when I'm sitting at my work desk, I want my monitor to appear as if it's here where a physical monitor would be. But when you turn your head away, it stays in that three-dimensional space. So, you know, if you're looking at your computer monitor and then you turn your head to the left, you don't see the monitor anymore.
Exactly.
Just like you wouldn't in real life.
Now, let me be the wet blanket skeptic.
I was going to mention something.
To bring things down a little bit. So everything that you guys are saying may come to pass at some point. But the thing that we have to keep in mind is that until we put this technology in the hands of lots of people, it's really hard to predict how people will want to use it.
Oh, absolutely.
And what it'll be useful for. So all the things that you guys are speculating about are speculation. So we don't know if this is going to be the smartphone where everyone's going to want to have them, and it's going to be much more useful than anyone ever thought, or if it's going to be the Segway, you know, where it's actually not going to be so revolutionary, but it will have a niche, you know, where people use it for certain specific things. Or, you know, guys, remember the high definition, high frame rate situation where there was something annoying about it, you know, that people have a hard time adapting to.
Oh, you're so full of it. That's a horrible analogy. Because this isn't a Segway. People are going to build cities around Segway. That was a ridiculous prediction. It's not like a Segway at all. This is an improvement on the computer interface. I mean, computer interfaces, they're not going anywhere. That's a proven technology. It's just another way. It's another type of monitor, Steve.
I know, Bob. I'm just saying, until people start using it, we won't know. It's like a video phone. Like we talked about the fact that, video phones are coming. Why wouldn't you use a video phone? And it turns out that for a lot of things, you don't want to be looking at somebody. Why is texting so popular? The use of technology is hard to predict.
I agree.
All right. Well, Evan, tell us about last week's Who's That Noisy?
I'll do one better and play for you last week's Who's That Noisy? Who could forget this wonderful little sound? Here we go. Definitely not a bird, definitely not a plane.
What is it?
Superman. That is the Whistle Pig.
The Whistle Pig.
The Whistle Pig.
What a great name.
What the hell is a Whistle Pig?
A groundhog.
Remember from Groundhog's Day?
We only covered it a few weeks ago.
That's an actual pig.
No, it's a groundhog.
Well, it's a groundhog.
The Whistle Pig is another name for the groundhog.
Right. Woodchuck is another name for the groundhog. Woodchuck. Some people call it a land beaver. And they're all over the place, especially in North America. Very common in northeastern parts of the continent and in the central United States. Several guesses, only a few correct answers this week came into us. So congratulations to Wayne Heller. Your name was drawn. You are the winner this week. You are in the drawing for the end of the year contest, by which we will put all the names in the hat from the week winners. And that grand prize winner will join us on the SGU to play a round of science or fiction. All right, so guys ready for this week?
Always.
Yes.
It is another noisy we have this week. It's short. Here we go.
Yeah, you're looking a little hot. All your calls will be a little early.
Okay. Yeah, that looks good here.
All right.
Isn't that when they made the $6 million man and, you know, he was about to crash? No?
That's an interesting guess, Jay. No, that's not correct.
I hope at some point in my life I'm going to be talking to someone and that whistle will come at the end tone. Yeah, I love that.
What I would like to see in the answer for this week is not just a generic idea of what you think the noise is. I would like to know pretty exactly where you recognize that noise from. Send us your guess, WTN@theskepticsguide.org. That's the email address for Who's That Noisy submissions. Or you can post it on our forums, sguforums.com. Every week, I wish you all the best of
luck. Good luck, everybody.
Thank you, Jay.
I was getting very excited, Evan.
All right, we have one question this week. This comes from Joe Schultz, and this is the shortest question we've ever had.
The answer is 6 inches.
4'1".
Joe writes, why do we say ow?
Wow, what a good question. Holy crap.
Can I try to answer it and see if I'm anywhere near correct?
You can try.
Okay.
The first thing that occurred to me when I read that email when it came in was, well, first, the word is cultural. I'm sure that in other cultures, they don't say ow, they say other things.
I'm guessing.
That's my guess as well.
The other thing is, I think we're giving a cue to the other mammals around us that we're injured.
Here's my guess. My guess is ow is short for ouch.
Why do we say ouch?
Because ouch is short for ouch-a-daisy.
Well, he didn't say why do we say ouch. That wasn't the question. So why do we say ow?
Yeah, but don't split hairs. Why do we make a vocalization when we get hurt?
Do you think there's any published scientific research that might enlighten us on that question?
I'm sure you know.
If there is, you have it, Steve.
All of these like evolutionary psychological answers, there's no answer to that. This is all hand waving. We don't know. No one knows. You could make up any kind of plausible sounding answer that you like for that.
So I'm right.
The answer is we don't know. That's what the answer is. But I did look at this from a couple of angles just to see what I could find. One was because I remember reading this study, but I wanted to just see what all the literature was about swearing and pain perception. I couldn't find anything published about saying ow or ouch, but I could find swearing. And the research does show that if you swear when you have like stub your toe or have physical pain, that your perception of that pain is decreased. It does help.
Wow.
However, get this. If you swear all the time, then the benefit of swearing goes down.
Fuck that.
Well, yeah, you've numbed yourself.
I could see that.
Yeah, so you have to keep your swearing in reserve for when you stub your toe.
Save it for the pain.
Save it for the pain.
What about instead of physical pain, what about emotional pain?
Yeah, well, we also use it in lots of related ways to, like when somebody says something that bad that happened, you might say, ooh, ouch, you know, as a way of saying, like, expressing sympathy. Or if somebody insults you really bad, you might say, ouch, like sarcastically to try to say, like, oh, you hurt me. I also had the same question. What is how international or cross-cultural is ow or ouch? So I looked it up. So here's a smattering of what other cultures say instead of ouch. I or ow are the two main things that cultures say. In French, I, Thai, oi, Spanish, I, Polish, ouch, Maltese, ah, Iran, I or ah or oof, Afghanistan, oof. Germany, it's an A-U-A, awa.
Awa.
Yeah. Dutch is ow. Norwegian, ow. Danish, it says A-V. I'm not sure if that's supposed to also be pronounced ow.
Probably.
Chinese, the only two-syllable one I came across of, ayo or aya. Turkish, ah or I. So very similar across those cultures. It's mainly a lot of I, ah, oof, ow. Very similar.
That's interesting,
too, that they're all, and they're all short.
A lot of A's, O's, and all short. The Chinese one was the only one I found that was two syllables.
Very cool. That's so interesting. I love that.
All right. We have a very interesting interview that we recorded at SciCon last October with John Ronson. We're sitting here now with John Ronson. John, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's good to be back. Thank you, Stephen. And it's nice to meet you all after I've heard 400 episodes of you.
Wow. Only 381.
Okay. John, I believe you owe us an apology.
I do owe you an apology. The last time I was on was to talk about my book, The Psychopath Test, and it was on my birthday. And it was quite late. It was like 11 o'clock at night. And unlike me, I was drunk. And it turns out that I am a befuddled and slightly angry drunk.
Because we couldn't tell the difference.
No, when I listened back, I was ashamed. Mid-sentence, I would drift off. I didn't know what I was talking about.
John was sharp as ever tonight, wasn't he? Yeah.
Well, actually, after the podcast, I accidentally typed my name into Google and I saw somebody said, God, John Ronson sounded weird on Skeptic's Guide. And the reason why was because it was my birthday. I'd been out with my family and I was drunk.
I don't think you told us it was your birthday.
Yeah, it's my birthday.
Warn us next time, okay?
Yes. But yeah, as you can see now, I'm as sharp as a pin.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Pithy, much more pithy.
Yeah, pithy as a pin.
So, John, can you please say to me, but of course I was drunk at the time.
I don't talk like that. More like someone like a buffoon from Downton Abbey.
I love that. I love it.
You sound like the first of the reboot of the Doctor's Who.
Right.
What was the actor's name? Not David Tennant.
Christopher Eccleston?
Yeah, Christopher Eccleston.
Wow.
What kind of accent does he have? Northern accent.
Yeah, I believe he's from the Northeast. I see him jogging maniacally in a park in North London. He's a big jogger.
Oh, interesting.
Maniacal. He's really running away from something.
Demons.
Maybe he is.
Personal demons.
Yeah, or Daleks.
Daleks.
John, what are you working on now?
And now I've started to write a new book on the subject. I don't want to talk too much about it because I don't want to kind of talk it all out. It always helps me to kind of internalize the thing when I'm writing it. But it's kind of on the subject of humiliation. Mm-hmm. I always like to start with a word. So the psychopath test, the word, I guess, was madness. And whether madness was a more powerful engine in our lives than rationality. And in The Menace of Goats, I guess the word was a phrase and it was irrationality at the heart of power. And them was like paranoia at the fringes of society. And the new word is humiliation. I'm very interested. I was really surprised, actually. I've just brought out this collection called Lost at Sea, and I was reading it as an audiobook, and I was amazed at 15 years of adventure stories, how often the subject of humiliation comes up, how often people said to me, my greatest fear in life was being humiliated, and here it was coming true. It seems to be a running theme in my stories.
And what about people who don't get humiliated? Are there any people who just...
Well, that's another interesting thing. I mean, psychopaths don't get humiliated.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they're immune to humiliation.
I think so, yeah. So it seems. They get annoyed, as you know. They get very cross if they feel slighted. So they've got terrible grandiosity issues. But when they're caught in a lie, they don't feel bad about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of Robert Hare's big things, feeling unembarrassed about being caught lying. But other people don't get humiliated too, and I'm really interested in those people.
So it's interesting to think, is the most powerful source of humiliation for the average person being caught in a lie, or is it, you know, like a lot of people will do the default, like, oh, I'm naked in public, I was humiliated. That wouldn't bother me at all. I could recover.
Could bother
from
everyone else.
But I definitely think being caught in a social lie, you know, where people know, oh, like, especially like stealing somebody else's work type of lie would be horrible. That would be horrible, right?
I can't think of anything worse than being the recipient of some kind of storm like that, like, you know, Jonah Lehrer or Mike Daisy, those people. To me, that's like, you know, that's the kind of thing that would wake me up.
And there's so many people right now in the sort of, you know, in what I feel is your field in a way, like the people who are writing these sometimes slightly fictionalized accounts, but of truthful stories, you know. And so, yeah, and David Sedaris went through this, like, and it's kind of sad, like, cause these are all people I love, and to see that happening.
Yeah, and I feel a bit sorry for Jonah Lehrer because, you know, his big crime was inflating Bob Dylan quotes or in fact inventing them. And as somebody pointed out in the wake of that storm, Bob Dylan's autobiography is full of made-up stuff, mm-hmm. yet nobody goes for Dylan. It does feel slightly subjective.
Also, you know, sometimes you can't tell what Dylan's saying anyway. He said anything.
You can't tell what he's singing, yeah.
I do know the thing that worried me was when before Jonah Lehrer got done for that, he was done for self-plagiarism.
Yeah.
What is self-plagiarism? Yeah,
well, it's basically using the same material, like say in an article for The New Yorker and then in a blog for Wired.
Yeah, lifting like word for word, same paragraph and dropping it into a different article usually.
But when I heard that, I thought, so he wasn't stealing somebody else's work, he was repeating his own work. And when I heard that, I thought, Frank Sinatra would sing My Way every night. Yeah. You know, is that the worst crime in the world?
Yeah.
I used to do that. And not worry. If I had like a really great line. There's a line in the psychopath test, where I'm talking about, how bankers were kind of ignored, like the wickedness of hedge fund managers and stuff was kind of ignored for a long time and they were getting away with it. And I said the reason why they were getting away with it was because they were boring and journalists don't like to write about boring people because the more colorful the prose, the better it looks for the journalist. So I said, if you want to get away with wielding true malevolent power, be boring. And I'd actually written something very, very similar to that a couple of years ago in a column for The Guardian, and it was completely ignored. And I thought, this is like a really interesting point. So I was happy to give it another shot in the psychopath test. And sure enough, it's become one of the more popular quotes in that book.
I don't see a problem with that. I mean, because what else are you going to say every single time? As I once said.
Yeah.
I mean, no.
I was surprised, actually, when that came up as an issue for Jonah Lehrer. It worried me that people were going to start going for journalistic misdeeds too much.
Yeah, it becomes a witch hunt. And I think some people are doing it because they can, because we have the technology, if you will, to sift through everything everyone's written. I know Gerald Posner faced that, where someone thought that he had plagiarized part of his book. And then somebody decided to like cross-reference everything he ever wrote, you know, and would sift with these, you know, searching algorithms where you could search everything, you know, he wrote and come up with all these other instances where lines from his research found their way into his books or his articles without being properly referenced. And he admitted, clearly my process has broken down here and I haven't been keeping track of, you know, where these lines were coming from. So he admitted that, you know, inadvertently things have crept in. But I don't know who can withstand that kind of really thorough scrutiny. I mean, we all have things rattling around in our head that we've heard from other people, and if you write a lot, it's going to, that stuff is going to end up in what you write.
Yeah, absolutely. It did worry me. It seems to be kind of drifting off a little bit now. And the funny thing about Mike Daisy, you know his story. He went to China and to Foxconn and was writing about the abuses that Foxconn were doing. Everything he wrote was true, but his grave error of judgment was he said he witnessed it all firsthand. The kind of tragedy of Mike Daisy is if he'd stayed in China for a couple of weeks longer, he could have actually got everything that he purported to get. All he had to do was get on a few more planes and go and meet a few more people.
Yeah.
And it would have been the greatest expose of Apple of all time. But he didn't.
And then I think even if he had, though, he still would have messed with the narrative because that was another huge thing, was not just that it didn't happen to him, but then he was screwing with the narrative, not in a way that just makes a better story arc, but in a way that drastically altered events, where they happened and how they happened. And I feel like even if he had stayed there a few weeks, because what he is at heart is a storyteller, and that's what he values. He doesn't value truth.
But isn't that the problem with journalism in general, is that ultimately it's a storytelling endeavor, and the truth or the facts become second nature?
Well, no, because I mean, it's
in importance to that.
It's possible, I think, to balance those things, to know how to take what you're seeing. It's like taking a photo. Mm-hmm. You know, you can take a photo. I could take a photo of something out the window right now, and then we could have a professional photographer come in and use the same camera and come up with something that's amazingly better. We're both representing the truth, but one of us has a better eye for how to capture it. And it's exactly the same.
But I think a better analogy there would be, then you take it onto Photoshop and maybe you color correct it a little bit, or you enhance the contrast, or then maybe you said, you know what,
a tree instead of this building would work a little bit better. That building's ugly. I'm going to put a tree there so it doesn't ruin.
That would be the,
And then there's a slippery slope. I'm talking more about the slippery slope of, yes, of course, all good journalism is storytelling. You know, John, you know this obviously better than any of us. You're a journalist and an author. You've written, obviously, you listed your most recent successful books, screenplays, et cetera. And there's either, you have to tell a good story, but at the same time, you're trying to convey an accurate portrayal of the subject matter, but isn't there this temptation to always tweak it to make the story a little bit better, even if it's not exactly true?
Well, I always try and make it true.
Yeah.
And it's, and a rather good thing about, you know, it's good to, it's, I feel sorry for the likes of Joan O'Leary for being, you know, the ones thrown into the bonfire.
Yeah.
But I guess a good thing about all of that is that it does keep everybody in check.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always try to keep it true. And I have never been, nothing bad's ever happened. You know, I've never, you know, so I've always been all right. Yeah, but you think about this every time you write something. It's really important. I always think it's the fact that I suffer from anxiety that stops me from transgressing. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, if I was tempted to shape something too much, to shape something so it was no longer accurate, no longer truthful, I would immediately envisage a horrific future.
Right.
Where
you play out a worst case scenario
exactly,
in your head.
Where it begins with Twitter and it ends with, you know, jumping off a building.
And that gets back to what we were saying earlier though, where like a psychopath or a, you know, someone that doesn't have those built-in social meters and thresholds is going to be capable of doing things that people like us won't be.
Yes.
And you're editing yourself in a way to limit your own anxiety. I do the same thing. I have a very similar process where I'm always like thinking about my actions and projecting them into the future. And it happens very seamlessly, right? It's not like you don't have to actually put a lot of energy into it. It's just part of the way your brain works.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. These what if scenarios that haunt people with OCD and so on. Yes. Psychopaths don't have that, which, you know, makes me suspect that psychopathy is the most pleasant feeling of all the mental disorders. Because all the things that keep us good, anxiety, guilt, remorse, and so on, is, am I right in saying, Stephen, the relationship between the amygdala and the central nervous system?
Yeah, well, amygdala is part of the central nervous system, but I mean, you mean like the frontal cortex, which is where all the social mores are, the social morals, the things that give you anxiety so that you internally police yourself and you don't do things because you're afraid of social humiliation. That emotion exists so that we can exist in a society. You know, we will, and in fact, you know, what the social psychology is showing is that people will essentially cheat exactly as much as they think they'll get away with. And it is more than anything else, the fear of social humiliation that keeps us from doing things which are inherently greedy or self-serving. You know, we are totally self-serving unless we think that other people's perception of us being self-serving is no longer in our best interest. So it's ultimately still self-serving.
There's something so unraveling about that. Like,
but we're chimpanzees. I mean, that's how we behave, just in a very sophisticated way. But again, psychopaths, they sort of lack that. It must be very freeing. And I think that's why they're very charismatic, very compelling characters. Because it's like, wow, imagine having the freedom to just really just do whatever you want.
And so difficult to treat, too, because there's no incentive to change. Uh-huh. People with anxiety disorders want to get better.
That ties into what you were saying about the not liking the haughtiness of skepticism. And that's, I think, one of the challenges that we have. It's hard to tell people they're wrong about something without coming off as being haughty. So,
I mean, the way I always get away with it is to be very open about my own irrationalities, my anxieties, and that sort of people can then connect to that on a sort of, you know, on a flawed level, I guess. People connect to me on a flawed level, and I think that helps. And sometimes, I think that's a good way around that, is to be kind of, but you do that, Stephen. You talk about everybody's irrationality.
Yeah.
You don't say skeptics are perfect.
No.
And that's very likable to do that.
I don't think anyone really does that. I mean, I think it's an inadvertent thing that it comes across, or that I think people are looking for a reason to dismiss what the skeptics are saying because they don't like the conclusion. It's like, oh, you're just being closed-minded and haughty. And it's kind of a cheap shot, I think, oftentimes. I do think that skeptics have evolved as a community to the point where we realize that, you know, that finger-wagging, haughty skeptic is completely ineffectual if we want to actually change people's minds. And in fact, it's not even really true that, you know, we are all irrational. It's a matter of having a process that deals with that. And
Yeah.
And understanding it.
Also, we talked at the beginning about this kind of humiliation idea. And the more kind of open you are about your weaknesses and so on, the less humiliatable you are.
These things
only kind of exist when you're keeping them as, you know, keeping them as secrets, keeping them in the darkness.
It is all part of the human narrative, right? So I think that's what you're, John, excellent at, you know, as an investigative journalist and a writer, is making you are a good storyteller, and they are very human, and you're very much in, you know, the stories, but the process comes out in that still.
Yeah, but to me, I think this, where I disagreed with what you said, was that I think self-deception, so these kind of more serious aspects of things, like the kind of, let's say, for want of a better phrase, the sort of the confirmation bias you find in the corpse instead of the confirmation bias you find in a haunted honky-tonk. I actually think people really are interested in it, because I think, you know, psychology books are really popular, and, you know, Richard Wiseman's books sell a lot of copies. And I think people do want to know about their own flawed thought processes, actually. I think, pleasure to see you all in the flesh. It's strange to actually hear these voices coming out of actual human faces.
we do have actual human faces.
We've shattered
faces,
your illusion, apparently.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
We are ready.
Yep.
Time to play.
Right. You'll find these are interesting.
Always.
Here we go. Item number one. Scientists have developed an imaging system that can look through walls into a burning building and identify survivors that need rescuing. Item number two, a new analysis finds that Spider-Man's webbing would have been strong enough to stop the commuter trains as depicted in the Spider-Man 2 movie. And item number three, researchers discover a virus with an adaptive immune system.
Wow.
Jay, you spoke first, so you get to go first.
The first one about scientists developing an imaging system that can look through walls into a burning building.
Let me guess, Google Glasses.
I don't see why I should doubt this. I think that, of course, it's using temperature difference, I'd imagine, to see where the survivors might be. Or, you know, they already have devices like this where they can see through, you know, 100% smoke-filled room. You know, they go in with the face mask and the oxygen, and they're walking through, and they hold this thing up, and it looks like a really big flashlight, but it has a viewfinder on it that will show them the heat differences. And I just don't see why this one is that big of a leap. So I'm just going to take that initially right off the list as that is science. The second one about Spider-Man's webbing being strong enough to stop a commuter train, or it would, you know, Spider-Man's webbing would be that strong if he was, you know, using that much spider web, I'm assuming, right, Steve? If that were real spider web and there was that much of it, it could do those things?
Yes, that's what the analysis showed.
Yeah, I would just imagine that that's a yes. If anything, I'd like to say I think it would be a lot stronger than that as well because of the things I do know about spider webbing. I don't know if all spider webbing is created equal. If every spider produces the same exact type of thing, I'd imagine there's huge variances in there. But that one seems completely legitimate to me as well. So, you know, I'm left with this last one, that researchers discover a virus with an adaptive immune system. I don't see why that sounds too crazy either. And, you know, we're talking about viruses here, which are these, you know, very small little critters that, you know, like bacteria. Why should I doubt it? But I'm really going to go with that last one as the fake because the other two just seem very plausible to me. And here's the roll. And it came up a 2. And so, like, once again, me and randomness do not agree.
Okay. All right, Bob.
See, I'll start with 3. The adaptive immune system. That's wicked. If a virus, I assume it's somehow, grabbing, what it needs to create its own immune system. That's pretty amazing. But considering that it can, I mean, it's designed to penetrate a cell and take over genetic machinery. I guess that seems somewhat plausible that it could do that, that it can somehow, that they found one with an immune system. I'm just assuming that it's somehow, you know, co-opted it from another organism. It seems to, you know, I think they that just kind of makes sense to me. I really hope that that's true. Let's see, the second one. Spider-Man's webbing. Yeah, I could totally see that. We all have heard over and over and over just how strong spider-web is. And Jay, you're right. There is a huge variance. There's a specific type of spider that creates the strongest dragline silk. If you scale that up, I could see how it would actually work. I mean, Jay, we're talking about a huge amount of momentum, huge amount of kinetic energy that it has to deal with. But considering that spider silk is also very good at maintaining its strength and stretching, I really believe that this would work. I really hope it does. The first one, this is the one I've got problems with. Yeah, I myself have talked about this specific type of technology where they could actually see through walls and buildings, and it's really amazing. But the technology is a little bit immature, I think, at this stage. It's got tons of potential, but the thing that's throwing me a little bit is the burning building. And you've got fire, you've got heat, can distort images incredibly. Fire! And I think the throwing the fire in the mix is what would make this not a viable technology, not yet anyway. That's a little bit too advanced. Seeing through a wall, yeah, but when you throw fire into the mix and heat and the distorting effects that has, I think you tweak this one a little bit. So I think that one is the fiction.
And Evan.
Bob and Jay each touched on really good things here on the two that they chose as the fiction, and I was kind of thinking the same thing, so I'm kind of split between those. As far as Spider-Man's webbing, strong enough to stop the train. Yeah, I mean, I guess if you have enough of it, it's some webs that are produced by spiders are pretty durable material, pretty strong in their own right. And you just need, I think it's a matter of quantity at that point. So therefore, I'm down to this, virus with an adaptive immune system. I don't know, in a way, would that be unfortunate? I mean, would this make viruses more difficult and cause sorts more problems for human beings? And the first one about looking through the walls into the burning building, identifying the survivors. So maybe it's not so much about the fire itself. Maybe it's more about finding the survivors and the heat that they're giving off. I'm in a burning building, right? Chances are I'm not in there kind of running around like a chicken with my head cut off. I'm probably, you know, just doing whatever I can to find shelter, or maybe I've gone, you know, unconscious but not have died from the smoke inhalation. And perhaps that's a key to this as to how they're able to detect a person who is alive and needs rescuing. So that means I have to sort of lean towards this virus with the adaptive immune system. I'm going to go with Jay and say that one is the fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that a new analysis finds that Spider-Man's webbing would have been strong enough to stop the commuter trains as depicted in the Spider-Man 2 movie. All think that one is science, and that one is science.
Sweet. Right.
Good job so far, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is a project by some physics students, and they did all the calculations. Would the webbing have had the strength to stop the momentum plus the engine? They included that as well because it was still running. You know, it wasn't just in
coasting. Yeah.
It wasn't coasting. Would it have been enough to stop the train? And they concluded that it would have been more than strong, more than powerful enough.
More than enough.
Yeah, just play. Very, very strong. It's stronger than steel. So if you just imagine steel cables, it kind of visually makes a little bit more sense. But I would say, though, I didn't point this out during, because nobody asked, but you know how in that movie where Spider-Man just sort of shot the webbing to either side and then stopped the train? That would have ripped him apart, right? I mean, even if the webbing wouldn't have been the weak link.
Right.
That made him like Superman. I mean, I understand Spider-Man is tough, but that I thought was ridiculous. He should have shot the web from one side to the other.
Right.
So just the web itself stopped the train. I think that's the calculation that the physicists did, the students did.
Yeah. I forgot that Spidey did that. Yeah, that was a little silly, but.
Yeah. So this is students from the University of Leicester, published in the Journal of Physics Special Topics. This was James Forster, Mark Bryan, and Alex Stone came up with a fun idea for their senior project. But yeah, not surprising. Spider webbing is ridiculously strong. And Some spider webs are stronger than others. They did use webbing from the toughest spider silk that is known. Do you guys know what spider that's from?
It's got bark in the name, doesn't it?
Yeah, Darwin's bark spider. Good job.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
That's the strongest known webbing of any spider, Darwin's bark spider.
Damn right.
All right, let's go back to number one. Scientists have developed an imaging system that can look through walls into a burning building and identify survivors that need rescuing. Bob thinks is alone in thinking that this one is the fiction. Jay and Evan think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Good job, Bob.
Yes.
Yes. Wow.
Well, although, Bob, you're right for the exact wrong reason.
Why?
Because scientists have developed an infrared digital holography that allows firefighters to see through flames and image people. So they solve.
Yes, of course.
Not
yes.
through smoke, but through flames. So they
made. No, Steve. My equation was the wall.
Well, yeah, the wall was.
And the fire. That's what made it difficult. Not the fire. I totally believe
okay.
they developed it through fire, but not wall and fire.
I thought
that's
you just
why.
Said through smoke, but the fire was the problem. But, all right, fine. But the smoke. That, as you guys all said, that's, you know, infrared imagers will see a body heat through smoke. No problem. But the problem has been when there's fire and smoke, the heat from the fire obscures the heat from the body and, it overwhelms it because you need sensitive detectors. Now you have this bright heat source. Especially if you have to like zoom in to try to find the person, that zooming in will completely overwhelm the sensors. So they developed an instrument that uses digital holography and uses an imaging system without focusing lenses so that it deals with that problem of getting too much heat, too much radiation into the system, overwhelming the sensors. And they were able to use it to separate out the image of a person from the background noise of the flame. But,
that's
but,
awesome.
But this, you'd have to be inside the building, with the person. So the bit that I changed was imaging from the outside. And you're right. We talked about this too, technology for looking through walls, but it's not nearly at this point where you could like look at a burning building and go, oh, there's a person on the second floor, in the closet or whatever. This means that researchers discover a virus with an adaptive immune system is science. This one's
cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really
awesome.
Cool.
Do you know what the virus is, Bob?
No.
It's
a bacteriophage. It's a virus that eats bacteria, that infects and kills bacteria. And
that's good.
The virus has adopted the adaptive immune system from a cholera bacteria. Interestingly, they think that it is sort of over its history, it incorporated genes from bacteria in order to co-opt its adaptive immune system, even though
tricky bastard.
Yeah, the modern cholera that it infects doesn't have those genes anymore.
Oh, awesome!
So this makes this bacteriophage, this virus, much more deadly to the bacteria. It's much more effective at it infects them, kills it, replicates, spreads, goes into more bacteria, infects them, kills them. Very effective. Evan, this would, if anything, be a good thing. These are viruses that do not infect people. They infect bacteria. And
I was hoping, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually possible to use them as a way of fighting off a bacterial infection. You think about it, they're little machines, bacteria killing machines. This is being developed as a bacteria fighting technology. And this bit about having an adaptive immune system actually can make them more effective. So it would be nice if it comes to fruition because of, the problems we're facing with antibiotic resistance. Pretty cool. All right. Well, good job, Bob.
Finally.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Mm-hmm. Steve, I have a great quote. It was sent in by a co-host named Steven Novelli.
Novella.
From he lives in Connecticut, Evan. Do you ever hear of this guy?
Vaguely familiar with him, yeah.
Steve, he lives in your house. Get up.
Look behind you.
And another coincidence, this is a Yale professor. So Steve, a Yale professor, sent a quote from a Yale professor. Did this guy give you like $5? What's the deal, Steve?
I think your identity's
I
been
just
stolen,
found the
Steve.
Quote and thought it was appropriate.
This is Edward Tufte, and he said or wrote, "The world is much more interesting than any one discipline." That's from Yale professor, Mr. Edward.
Tuft!
Yeah, so I like that because we talk about that all the time. You know, everyone has their little perspective on reality based upon whatever their expertise is, but the world is so much more complicated that no one discipline can capture it all, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we brought this up many, many times. I think even last week I said there are scientists who are great at something, whatever their specialty is, but when it comes down to a lot of the other things that they're interested in that they don't have a specialty in, they think that they can apply their same level of assurance to those things as their specialty, yeah. And they fall flat. And it's a deadly combination of being intelligent and blind to critical thinking.
Hey, what about the corollary to that? The universe is much more interesting than any one world.
Yeah, it's just
the polyverse is much more.
The multiverse.
Multiverse. Yay, multiverse.
Guys, I'm so excited about Nexus. I cannot wait to go. It's going to be such a fun weekend. I'm especially excited not only for Steve and George's little workshop that they're going to do. I think that's on Friday, right?
Little workshop?
Well.
It's a little insignificant thing.
It's the little workshop of horrors.
It's a little. Yes. There's only two people in that workshop. But I'm most excited about the keynote physicist Leonard Mlodinow. He's going to be so fascinating. I've read some of his stuff and seen some of what he's done. I'm just so excited to see and meet this guy and see what he's got to say. It's just going to be such an incredible weekend.
I can't wait. He wrote The Drunkard's Walk, a classic. Yes. And also, I didn't know this, he co-wrote A Briefer History of Time with Stephen Hawking.
I said did that. He? Yeah, I told you guys about it. You don't remember? Yeah.
Oh, I mean, yeah, that's right. That was him. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he's a great speaker. And we haven't met him or interviewed him before, so that's going to be awesome.
Also, Steve, what about John Ronson? He's going.
John Ronson's now on the lineup as well. He's hilarious. I love that guy. He has that perfect dry sense of humor.
British wit. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I love it.
Very, very humble guy too. Like
self-deprecating.
So happy that he just didn't have an ego attached. Like he's just a great guy.
Yeah. Guys, also before we go, I wanted to mention briefly that the Science-Based Medicine crew has published a series of 12 ebooks, which are compilations of our best posts on specific topics. So you have the Science-Based Medicine Guide to Homeopathy, Guide to Naturopathy, Guide to Acupuncture, etc. 12 topics. You can get these through Kindle, through iBooks, or for the Nook through Barnes & Noble. The JREF, the James Randi Educational Foundation, is being kind enough to be the publisher of these for us. So this is a way of supporting science-based medicine and the JREF at the same time. I understand they make fabulous gifts.
I'll take 4.
You could take 12. So check it out. You could go to the science-based medicine website, and there are permalinks on the website for them, but also the post describing them will be at the top for a while just so people can find it easily. So check them out. And thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
You're welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Dr. N.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website. Or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.